On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Haya, and Haya was married to a neglectful, cheating abuser. It's a story of facades, gaslighting, mask slipping, intimidation, and physical abuse. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. I am Brandon Chadwick, and with me today, we have Haya. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, thank you for being here today, Haya. And if you want to be a guest like Haya is today, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our guest form page. And there you can read all of our instructions and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. And today's episode has a content warning, as we do discuss physical abuse and child physical abuse in this episode. So that is your content warning for today. And today we're going to hear Haya's story, and Haya's story is a slow build story. The family life just isn't the life that they really wanted to lead. So when questions are asked, you know, when Haya starts to ask questions down the road, gaslighting begins. And slowly, you know, piece by piece, you're going to hear a story where the mask starts to slip and the realization that everything is fine as long as Haya's husband isn't questioned. And they like to do the bare minimum as part of being a family member. And it's really just a big variation on the frog in the boiling pot kind of story. So a big thank you to Haya for being here today. And now I'm going to get out of my way and your way. Haya, the floor is now yours.
Brandon, thank you for having me tonight. My name is Haya. I'm an only child, and I grew up with a large extended family in my early years. My maternal grandparents were the source of my extended family. I had lots of aunts, uncles, cousins on that maternal side, very close with my grandmother and grandfather. And they were married over 64 years. So I was used to seeing a couple together, married long term. My own parents are married over 50, and there's no divorce in my family I can remember. So divorce was something that was uncommon to me. My father was the son of a single mom. He was raised on the streets in the 40s, and he became very independent, very resilient because of growing up as a young man with no parental supervision. And he instilled in me from a young age to be resilient, to have a never give up attitude. And in some ways that would serve me really well in my life. And in some ways it would play a part in my inability to give up on a marriage later on in life. When I was 10, we moved from a suburb to rural parts. This was a big transition for me. I didn't fit in easily where we moved to. I was in the fifth grade. It was an awkward time to begin with. I was tall. I had dark hair, olive-toned skin, and the town I moved to was largely German and Irish. So I was the darkest skinned person they had ever seen. Diversity was not here in the town, and I kind of felt like a square peg in a round hole. I eventually made a lot of friends, but my formative years left me feeling inside like I was often different and alone. By college and grad school, I was more self-assured, and I had a lot of friends then and was successful in college, successful in grad school. I was a straight-A student. I got a great job in the field of fundraising out of graduate school, and I enjoyed a lot of time in that field raising money for different causes. My ex, in his early years, was raised by a teen mom and dad in their late teens. He also, like me, had a large family of grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. And he lived with his paternal grandparents as a baby and a little boy. My ex's paternal grandfather's side was known to be what I would call slippery. His grandfather was often betting large amounts of money in card games and upholding people to their losses. He actually won my ex, he said, a pony in a card game once, which I thought was kind of interesting. Family members often recounted how my ex was the prince of the family, especially as a child living with his grandparents. He recounted how he was the only member of the family who had a color TV in the house because he was considered so special and no one else could use it. And my ex adored his grandfather. He looked up to him and he tried to please him a lot. He valued his opinion. And then his grandfather died unexpectedly when he was 8. My ex would describe his own father from the time I met him as a man of convenience. This was kind of an odd way to describe your dad. I would ask him what he meant by it, and he said he would never go out of his way for them, even from children, that he was often absentee, his dad, and his mom was the only one who would show up for he and his brother as kids. He recounted how his dad cheated on his mom when he was 15 years old and the ways in which that hurt his mother. And more than once in our relationship, he said he never wanted to be like his dad. That was something he was clear about.
So I do want to point out here everything you just said, because this is essentially the story you're about to tell. Your ex is about to reenact their whole childhood in a way they said they didn't want to be, but it is happening. It happened. And I just wanted to point that out there, that this is a reenactment. So I apologize there and continue.
I did find it kind of disturbing when I was dating him that my ex had a brother, and the brother seemed to fill a role designed by my mother-in-law as the problem child. And my ex served the role as the perfect child. And she would often describe them like that, even as adults. And I thought it was awful, you know, just to be calling adults still the perfect child and the problem child. Something that stuck with me that I remembered was my brother-in-law saying when I was dating my ex that my ex did all the messed up things he did. But the difference was my ex just never got caught, where my brother-in-law did. My ex would brag how he never took a book home, but he was class president and valedictorian. When he got to college, he failed out by sophomore year because he wasn't acquainted with working hard for results, because much up until that point, everything came easy to him. The work ethic that he needed to succeed in college wasn't familiar to him. His family often, I would say, described him as cool, calm, collected. I would describe him that way, very buttoned up man. You would never expect the outburst that would happen from his demeanor. So early dating, when I met my ex, I was divorced about 2 years and had a son from a previous marriage. He had dated someone 10 years, was married to her for 5 and divorced. At the time we met, I was 33, he was 35, and we met online on a dating site. I remember being really content, single, hoping to share my life with someone special if that was possible, but it wasn't necessary. I was divorced, I had my son, and I was content. I was renting an apartment, working full-time, and raising my son successfully on my own at that point. When I first met my ex, he seemed quiet, a bit mysterious. I remember not being able to tell if he was simply a man of few words or if he was arrogant. And that really bothered me. That was something early on in dating with him, it kept needling at me. Is he quiet or is he arrogant? Because I didn't like arrogant men. We dated for a year before we got engaged, and it was a whirlwind romance. I had never loved anyone like I loved him. He was like no one I had ever dated either. He was kind. He was attentive. He was largely a man of his word. The words matched the actions all the time. He was thoughtful, bring flowers to dates. He would open car doors. He would pay attention to little details, like making sure we had a great table at a restaurant or seeing a comedian I mentioned in passing I liked. He had a good job, and he had been at the company for over 5 years at that point. He had just bought a new townhome, leased a new car, so he appeared very stable. There was nothing I could put my finger on and say, well, this doesn't seem right. At the time, I was renting an apartment, and he would often come after work, and we would grab dinner, and as the months progressed, he would stay over and head to work in the morning. By the time the winter came, it was understood that we were falling in love with one another, and it was mutual, made clear. At that point, we made plans to go on our first trip together for my birthday, and we went on that trip. And by the end of the week, I remember vividly thinking that if he asked me to marry him, I would say yes. So after that year, we got engaged. I moved into his townhouse with my son, and he was awesome with my little guy. He was an amazing stepdad. He did all the things you'd expect a father figure to do with a child. We got married twice. The first was a civil ceremony at a local courthouse. He suggested that marriage. Our plan was to get married in November of that year, but I didn't have health insurance. And he said to me, let's do a civil ceremony so you can go on my health insurance. And I thought that was so thoughtful of him. Like, look, he's already trying to protect me as his wife. So the marriage started off great. After the wedding, we moved from New Jersey to Minnesota. My ex was offered a job that was a significant pay raise, so it was worth it for us to relocate. And I was excited to try a new part of the country to live. And soon after we arrived there, my ex and I decided I would stay home with my son versus seeking work in this new environment. I had always wanted to be a stay-at-home mom for my son because when I divorced, my son was only 1 year old, so it wasn't a possibility then for me to stay home. So I always felt like I lost time with him as a little guy. And with the increase in my ex's salary at his new job and the low cost of Midwest living, me staying home was finally financially possible. I felt my ex was amazing for being a man who valued a woman who stayed home to raise her child. And I thought he was caring about my son to have his mom fully present and that he and I shared values and what was right for our family. But what I realize now is that this was the first step in my ex making me fully dependent on him financially. So when we got married and we moved to this new state and started looking at our finances, I recall telling him that I wanted to be a team with him, and I wanted to have a real budget that we could create together. This was something that was really important to me, the finances, because I had handled all of my finances up until this point. And I had no debt. In fact, I had savings. I handled my money well. I had perfect credit. So I felt like I was a real asset in managing money. But he said he felt like there was too many cooks in the kitchen. And he kept saying that he had a system that worked and it would be better if I left it to him. And I wasn't easy about it. I didn't have ease about that. But he told me that in order for me to continue to stay at home, I really had to trust him with this. And I didn't want to make him feel like I didn't trust him or I wasn't behind him as his spouse. And, you know, he was making at that point now all of the money. So he mentioned to me, though, that he wanted me to add my son's child support monies to our household budget as my contribution, that since I wasn't working, if I wanted to do something, I could give my son's child support contribution. And I was really uncomfortable at that idea because I wanted to try and save part of those monies for my son's college fund. But again, I felt like if that monthly contribution made him feel like we were a team, I should do it. And I was staying home. I was not otherwise financially contributing. So in the end, those monies I gave him, you know, ironically, not only could have paid for my son's education, but they could have helped me exit the marriage when I had no money. As we started to continue to spend time in the new area that we were in and he got used to his job, the red flag started to pop up pretty quickly with female coworkers. I started to see a real lack of boundaries with his female coworkers. He made a point of telling me that at work, he tried to keep women in his corner so that if he needed anything, they'd be happy to help him. He reminded me a lot of times that he failed out of college and that without a college degree, he felt he had to work harder than everyone else to get ahead at work. And that this was just part of, like, quote unquote, office politics. After that, my ex's company offered for us to move from Minnesota back east and for my ex to work for the company virtually. And at this point, we had a second child and I was pregnant with a third. We moved into a townhome in October of that year. And I would say life was good. You know, by May of that following year, I had my first daughter. And we were a normal couple. We were happy, but tired, you know, from dealing with children. We were making friends in the town we were living in. I was meeting other stay-at-home moms. And I was starting to feel like I was really gaining roots in our local community. Around the birth of my daughter, though, his job was eliminated by the company. And they started closing down the facility. So my ex took a new job in a comparable field with better compensation. And he traveled pretty regularly, but not constantly, so it was manageable. I would say life was pretty well balanced at the time with him working and time spent as a family. And then I found out I was pregnant at 40 with our last daughter. Around the late summer or early fall, my ex started to talk about taking a new job with a major competitor in his field. It was a leader in the industry, and he seemed very determined to take a position with this corporation. But I had major reservations of him leaving this current job and taking this new one because the company was known for having very little work-life balance for its employees. And ironically, one of my closest friends had worked there years prior in HR and warned us that while he worked with the brightest people in his field, it wasn't going to afford him ample time for much beyond work. And we were going on 4 kids. So it was more important to me he was home and present as much as he could be for as a husband and a father. So I was clear with him as to my concerns, and I told him how I'd prefer we have him around more versus the extra money, and that the added income wasn't going to be worth it to me because what mattered to me most was he was a husband and he was a father who was present. And he just completely devalued my feelings and opinions on this new job. He acted as if my feedback mattered, like that we were making the decision together. But in spite of me being at the time 7 months pregnant and begging him not to, and telling him like what an adjustment it was going to be to have this fourth child, this new job is just going to be too much, he fronted like I was part of the decision-making process. But after the fact, I realized he had already taken the job. And I was nowhere in that decision. It was just smoke and mirrors to make me feel as if my opinion mattered, as if my opinion was important. And this was a job that, I mean, it was going to require 60% longer work week, more travel. It wasn't a small adjustment. So he took that job and I gave birth to my daughter. I remember him only taking a day or two after her birth off. I had a C-section. I had 3 other kids at this point that were, you know, under the age of 12. And he encouraged me to have his aunt come and stay with me for the week to help me, which honestly served him well because he didn't have to come home on time or pitch in. And she was there instead of him. So what we start to see, at least for me looking back, is now the household is starting to get very siloed, meaning I'm doing everything now. He's traveling constantly. He's working constantly. He's leaving early. He's coming home late. And I'm handling all of it. So, you know, I've got a newborn and I'm doing doctor's appointments for, you know, you have a lot of doctor's appointments for babies when they're little. You know, I'm doing all of that. I'm doing all of the homework, the housework, the transportation. You know, he used to say he had summer Fridays. I don't think I can remember more than one Friday in the summer that he got home before 4 o'clock and would just blame it on, well, it was, you know, not guaranteed. It depended on what happened at work that day. But I just think he was avoiding his responsibilities as a husband, a father, and just didn't want to be there, frankly. You know, most parents, they have an evening routine with their children. Maybe it's dinner, maybe it's a bedtime story. And most parents enjoy that time, especially if they've been gone all day, right? They haven't seen the children and they want to connect with them. But that's not what I saw with my ex. You know, they'd be super excited to have him read them a story or watch a show with them. But he always lamented he wanted to get them down to bed quickly so he could get some time with me. That was often the excuse. So I want to get time with you as my wife. So, I mean, who could argue with that, right? Like, well, that's a positive thing. But in retrospect, I realized he really wanted neither. But I became his excuse for not spending time, quality time with the children. And, you know, he wouldn't tell me often what I could or couldn't do. But he would lead me to a decision with two options, let's call it, that he predetermined. Or he would make the consequences of the action so undesirable that I wouldn't want to do it anymore. So, for instance, like if I tried to get, let's say, mom time, I'd want to tap out from mothering, especially if he was traveling a lot. You know, reasonable request, right? You know, you're watching children night and day. You want to hand the child off when the parent gets home a little bit and tap out. Maybe he was taking a yoga class. He never said I couldn't do that. But if I would go and do it, then he would call me during that, let's say, hour or so and tell me all the things that were going wrong at home while I was out. It was common for the children to cry in his care, too, because he ruled with an iron fist with them. And so when they cried, he'd tell them, you know, to be quiet, or he punished them for crying. And that type of abuse of the kids, I was really upset by. And so because of this, I became scared to leave them alone with him. I just came to believe it wasn't worth trying to get self-care because he would repeatedly call while I was gone for even short trips. So the goal of tapping out to relax was never achievable. There was no ability to recharge or come back a better mom to my kids because I never really got uninterrupted moments without worry or guilt. My ex never, again, really flat out told me, you can't do that, but the consequences swayed me not to. The other way he would control, kind of manage, I call it managing down expectations in my mind, was when he would travel, you know, he would travel at times that often had a time difference. And so, or he'd be very busy with meetings or tell me he was very busy with meetings. And so he would tell me when he was going to check in with the kids and I. And when he called, he would make sure he only had like 5 or 10 minutes to speak, usually before a company dinner or a cocktail hour he was to attend. So to limit how much of his time it would take up. And he was very inflexible with these check-ins. He blamed it on a busy work schedule or time difference or, you know, something else. But it was clear that I wasn't welcome to call him other than those designated check-ins. And it became the norm. He normalized it for me. And the other part of this, I would say, is, you know, I didn't dare complain about it because then he would say I was unreasonable or I was demanding or I was being ungrateful for the sacrifices he was making for our family because he was providing, right? Like he was on these trips earning a six-figure income. Who was I to complain that he wasn't available? So I would say the first time I saw any signs of real red flags on a business trip would be a trip he took to Las Vegas. He got on his trip to Las Vegas. And before he went, one of my sons had a health issue that landed him in the ER, like literally the day before he left. So we didn't have time to discuss what happened with our son before he headed out. And my hope was I could catch him after, you know, his dinners that first night to discuss it with him. And when I called him, you know, there's that time difference between the East Coast and Vegas. And I told him the reason I was calling, you know, I want to talk to you about our son. And it was very loud in the background. It was clear that he was out. And I will never forget him saying to me, "I'm sorry, I have a $250 shot here in front of me. Can I call you back tomorrow morning?" And he hung up on me. And I was stunned. I mean, I was just furious that this is what was prioritizing. Liquor over talking to each other about our son. And I blamed it on the stresses of work, his travel schedule, supporting four children, and maybe he just needed to blow off steam. I was trying to be supportive and understanding of him and the challenges that we all face in balancing home and life and work.
So cracks are really starting to show, more time away, set times for calls, unavailability. He's doing the bare minimum. He's not valuing your time and sabotages it if he does give it to you. It's not like he's saying no, you know, you're making the decision, but it's just this really good trick that's going on. Things are revolving around his needs, but he makes it that he's doing it all for you. There's just like a big disconnect. And he's saying he's making the money for all of you, but the actions when home and away, it's just very neglectful toward all of you, especially not caring what's happening with your child in the ER. That's a big thing. It's almost a full recreation, a reenactment already of what his dad was like. And this is where you see the first financial irresponsibility and, you know, start to kind of question, like, what's kind of going on overall? Like, things start happening here, and it's an opportunity to see that maybe more is going on. So walk us through this.
You know, as this went on with this travel, it was getting worse and worse. So he had to travel often to Vegas. He took a second trip pretty quickly after this first one. It was the middle of the winter here on the East Coast, and we got frigid weather and snow. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and the house was freezing. And I thought the furnace had broke. So I called the emergency service. The young man came out to take a look at it, and I could tell he didn't want to tell me why the heat wasn't working. It finally came out that he hadn't paid the heating bill in months. So like the oil bill had not been paid in months and months and months. It was close to $1,000 we owed. And I'm stunned because, again, I'm thinking he's taking care of all the bills, right? He's on top of this. He's taking care of us. So I called my ex. And he was clearly annoyed when he answered the phone. And I told him, there's no heat. And he brushed it off and he said, you know, I'm sorry. I was just so busy with work and my constant travel. I didn't have a chance to get to all the bills. Just put it on your credit card. And I just remember how nonchalantly he told me to use the credit card. He recommended some space heaters I should use. We had... But he never apologized. He never seemed concerned about the well-being of his kids. We had an infant daughter. And this was the first time when he returned from that trip that I really started to question the state of our finances. But he swore he was just catching up on outstanding bills he hadn't gotten to because of work. So around this time, when he's getting back from business trips, you know, he's working for a company that is spoiling their employees. You know, he's flying first class. Sometimes he's gone 10 days at a time at some gorgeous location. He's staying at the most luxurious hotels. He's drinking $200 cocktails. He's eating at the priciest restaurants with elaborate corporate sponsored, you know, entertainment. But he's coming home after I've been holding down the fort for all that and telling me I need me time. And I was pushing back. You know, I was saying to him, well, what about me? You know, I'm caring for four kids single-handedly all that time you're gone. I'd like some me time. when you come home. But it was out of the question. The only person's needs that mattered were his. And if I suggested I needed respite, I was told I wasn't thinking of his needs. And I was clearly struggling then, balancing being a stay-at-home mom. So it was turned on me. I was gaslit up that, no, I'm not handling my responsibilities well if I need that.
So eventually you are able to convince him to take a trip by yourself with others. He wasn't thrilled with this, but he agreed. And it meant that he had to take care of kids by himself. And the first call you had was with your eldest son, and it was very upsetting. So walk us through this.
The first morning I was there, I called home to check in, see how everything was going. And my oldest son, who was 11 at the time, took the call and was just hysterical. He was hysterical crying, saying he was struggling with me gone, which is understandable. I mean, I had never been away from him. And he didn't want to go to school. And as a result, he was holding my ex up for his departure to work because he wouldn't get on the bus. This is the first time I would see physical violence, I would say, exhibited from my ex. He got on the phone and he started screaming at me that my son, not our son, my son was an asshole. He used that word. He's an asshole. And that now he was going to be late to work because of my son's temper tantrum. And I tried to explain to him, like, listen, he's just upset. But he wouldn't hear of it. And while I was on the phone, he went over to the couch my son was on and flipped it with my son sitting on it. I mean, I was just panicked. What's happening with my son? He didn't have a cell phone. So the cell phone he talked to me on was my ex's. I come to find out that he left my son home alone all day and he went to work, which was over an hour away from my son. And from that point on, things just started to catapult. It was like a train that just started to derail off a track that I could see coming a mile away.
So now a physical abuse has taken place against your son, then leaving him home by himself. It shows complete deregulation, that he's possible of being deregulated. And then you're trying to still be a teammate. So you want to be a team on finances. So you bring in an advisor, and now you see a huge financial responsibility, like massive boom, that will start you to kind of go down a path of really questioning, well, what else might be going on underneath this hood that I don't know about? So walk us through this.
So around this time, like, okay, I need to start really understanding these finances. So I hired a financial planner to sit on a Zoom call with us and help us set up like a financial portfolio, set up college funds for the kids. And I was excited. I was excited to finally be a team with him about our monies as a couple, plan for our future. But, you know, we get on this call and within a few minutes, the financial advisor asks us, is there any debt? And I answered no. Now, keep in mind, we're on a Zoom call. And my ex answers yes. And I look at him puzzled because we had one joint checking account together and I had one credit card that I knew had very little charged on it. So the financial advisor asks us, well, what kind of debt? And my ex said credit card. And then he asked him how much. And he said $150,000 on 15 different cards. And I almost passed out. I stayed silent until the end of that 60-minute call. I don't know how. And the minute we got off, I started questioning him. Like, why did he have 15 different credit cards without my knowledge? What did he spend the monies on? Where? How come? Why is he telling me now for the first time? He stood by the position for the rest of the marriage that he spent those monies on household expenses. In spite of giving him my son's child support every month, in spite of a six-figure income, in spite of a company credit card for work-related travel expenses, it did not add up. And I knew it didn't add up. But he kept stressing now how ashamed he was. So it was becoming about him. And I have to tell you, people asked me, you know, why didn't you go through the receipts to know where the monies went? So truthfully, looking back, the idea of leafing through, you know, years worth of receipts for 15 different credit cards was totally overwhelming and totally exhausting. It just was not feasible. I mean, I was exhausted at the thought of it. And truthfully, looking back, I was burying my head in the sand because I was scared of a truth that I didn't even know could be a truth. So at this point, this is the first time I start bringing family into my world. Up until now, you know, I was not sharing with my parents anything or friends what was going on. My father recommended, when I told him about the amount of money, that we go and hire a bankruptcy lawyer and that we declare bankruptcy because there was no way we were going to dig out of this. And so I respected his opinion and his knowledge, and we took that recommendation. I will tell you, one of the hardest parts of this process was when you're married, the other person's debt is your debt. So it didn't matter I was on one credit card and he was on 15. We had a joint checking account together. So my credit score, which I was always proud of, went from 800 plus to 200 overnight. And that was devastating because I was starting to think, even though I wouldn't admit it, if I wanted to get out of this marriage, I have no way now. I can't rent a place because my credit's ruined and I have no money. He had trapped me through financial ruin. And now I was unemployable from staying home with the kids because I was supporting his career. So I was totally dependent on him at this point. For about 6 years, we paid close to $600 a month to pay off that bankruptcy agreement. And during that time, you know, it wasn't just about the paying the money. I couldn't lease a car. I couldn't finance a car. I couldn't own a credit card. I had to pay cash for everything, which also translated into further control of him over the money because he was the only one working. So he would hand me cash every 2 weeks, and I had no access to any more money than that, what he handed me. And I had to provide him with receipts for everything I bought with that cash. I would say the discovery of that debt is what I would consider to be the catalyst for abuse through the remaining of the 7 years of this marriage. It's almost like my ex knew I was onto him now, once I discovered the debt. And because I didn't see him as perfect anymore, he was beginning to spiral out of control. And he was leading a totally separate life and one I had not been privy to. I would say when I look back on his demeanor at this point, he's increasingly distant. He's emotionally unavailable. He's physically absent. He's irritable. The truth was he was leading a totally separate life and just one I was not aware of.
So that's how he's acting. How are you feeling?
Scared. Frightened because I am starting to have cognitive dissonance. I believe him to be this upstanding, phenomenal husband and man. And I'm starting to see a very different him. And I don't know who that is. And my brain for a while really could not rectify those two people. It could not make sense of that.
You're dealing with a very slow frog in the boiling pot type of story, except with him, if he was able to not get caught in doing anything, you most likely would not ever have encountered any of this. But once that crack is there, he's not used to people seeing or looking for things. And now someone is, and that's a problem for him, that he's going to be questioned And once more questions come for him not being able to lead this very carefree life in any way that he wants. Now this becomes a problem for him, because before you were on par, you're on the same page. But as soon as you question, hey, you're on this page that we both agreed upon, except you're also on this other page over here that I don't know existed. Now that you're questioning that page, you become a problem.
Oh, yeah, I became a big problem. And I was becoming more and more of a problem because I was starting to poke holes, ask questions. And now I was starting to ask questions and get louder and louder in my questioning. I would say throughout our marriage, I would often want to accompany him on business trips. And when I say accompany, I mean like one or two a year. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money and we had a lot of kids and I was realistic, right? Like maybe I'm going to get on one trip a year with you and piggyback on it. And it would give us time, I thought, you know, as a couple, some respite for me as a mom. I'd get to see places I never got to go. And he would constantly make excuses of why this isn't going to be an option. And again, it was always that logical excuse of why it wasn't going to work. And we couldn't get childcare. It was going to be too expensive. The flights were too pricey. You know, the company would frown upon it. That was a big one. They would question him then if he was focused on his work, if I was there. Nobody brought their spouse. That was another big one. Nobody brings their spouse. It's not the culture of the company. So, I mean, who am I to argue with the culture of the company? I didn't know if that was true or not, because keep in mind, it's not really like I ever knew the company. When he took this job at this new corporation, I never saw the inside of that building. I never saw his desk. I never met any of his coworkers other than a yearly Christmas party. He kept that world of work so separate that I would feel like I had no way if it really was the culture or it wasn't the culture. And again, I would say to myself, well, he doesn't have a college degree. So maybe he's really worried about proving himself at work, that he's focused on his task on this business trip. So I'm still trying to be understanding, right, of why. But it got to a point where I was like, listen, it's not going to fly. I want to go on a trip.
Did you feel at any time, specifically at the beginning of the relationship, that you being married to him and having a child initially was part of you being a role as far as who he was at work, that work might have wanted a family man type of thing, and that you were brought in to be presented as that thing to fulfill that role so he could move around? But, you know, over time, as we already said, like when cracks started to show, he's leading this other life. Do you feel that like that was part of what might have been going on as far as who you were to him, who your kids were to him?
Oh, for sure. I mean, again, in retrospect, I realized that this is a person, it's kind of like he's not the most social guy and he has to blend in. And so how do I blend in? Well, I present an image that I'm a family man. I have this beautiful wife. I have these beautiful children. You know, I can talk to people who are married and have kids at work because I have that in common with them. It gives me some commonality, some common ground. But really, I'm just part of the picture to make it seamless, flawless, easier for him. It's all smoke and mirrors, and I am not aware at all. Not one bit.
You are, and the kids are props.
Yeah, we're just, the way I describe it is picture a baby mobile. He's at the center of the mobile. And all the pieces in the mobile that orbit around the center, that's us and the children. That's us. It's his world. We're living in it. So I would say at this point, you know, we start going to counseling because I'm struggling with the no travel thing and I can't piggyback on a trip. It's really starting to become an issue. And in counseling, I'm noticing he's really arrogant. He's really smug. You know, and I don't like this. I'm seeing this side of him now, this kind of prideful, egotistical, why am I here? Why are you questioning me with the counselor, with me? You know, he's accusing me of having trust issues now, not being understanding enough of his work schedule, his needs. I was unsupportive of his job and his mind because I would voice how exhausted I was because he was absent constantly. And he would alternate in counseling between silence and it all being my fault. Those were the two pillars. But around this time, I discovered a cell phone number coming up on his phone every night after work. And he was speaking to a female coworker who was out in Minnesota that he would work closely with when he had to visit that satellite office. And I questioned him why he was chatting with this woman after work hours. And he blamed it on the time difference. Now, we're not talking a huge time difference. And I found it hard to believe that between 9 and 6, he couldn't catch her. So now I was made to look insecure, unstable, and untrusting to a female coworker. I was being painted with the crazy brush. A few months later, it was around Christmas time. And this was the only benefit I really got of the job was a Christmas party once a year that I got to attend with him. And so I was super excited. I got all dolled up. And I was excited to enjoy the night with him. I was excited to meet his coworkers in spite of everything that had been happening. I remember him introducing me to one male coworker, and then we settled with a female coworker who worked in another department and her husband. And for nearly an hour, he and this female coworker told inside jokes, which left her husband and I totally out of the conversation and looking and feeling very awkward. I remember them not seeming to care, my ex and this female coworker. And she mentioned to me during that time that my ex shared with her I was on Weight Watchers and that she was surprised because I was thin and I didn't need it. So here comes the blindsiding of what does this woman know about me as his wife? Like, these are very intimate details to be telling a coworker. And I felt vulnerable, like blindsided and vulnerable, angry that I felt like I had to justify personal choices to a total stranger. When I went to sit down at the table, there was an empty seat next to me at the table. And I remember patting the seat like you do for someone to sit down, for him to sit there. But he said, I'm going to sit across the table from you so I can see you. And he walked around the table and sat across from me and said, next to this female coworker. So she was in between he and her husband. I was absolutely stunned. I couldn't believe he had the nerve to do it in front of me, in front of her husband, that he was so bold. And I was just overwhelmed by the feeling of I don't rank. Feeling degraded, humiliated. I went to the bathroom and I took a single picture of me alone trying to smile because to this point, we still hadn't gotten a picture. And to this day, I look at that picture when I need to remind myself of how far I've come in this process of healing. I was broken at that point on every level, but I didn't really understand that fact because I was in it. And I vividly remember contemplating calling a cab from the restroom and taking the hour and a half ride home alone without even telling him because that's how furious I was. And I really thought to myself, he probably won't even notice I'm gone. When I got into the car with my ex and questioned him about it, he told me, you see, this is why I don't bring you on trips or introduce you to people at work because I don't want to hear about it after. So here it was. Here was the turning of the table. Why don't I take you on trips? Why don't I bring you into this world? Because then I have to, quote unquote, hear about it from you. So I was being manipulated to be silenced now. I was being gaslit, but I didn't know it. I still didn't know it. I didn't know what these tactics were or how to identify them or what to call them. And maybe it wouldn't have mattered anyway, but I didn't know. After that, there was some additional travel. There was a trip coming up to Austin that I really wanted to go on. And I told him, I said, listen, I want to go on this trip. And he said, okay, let's see how much the tickets are and we'll get you a ticket. And so I was really like, okay, maybe it's going to get better. A couple months passed. I followed up with him. And he said to me that he had to book the trip quickly and that he couldn't bring me. And I was upset again, disappointed again. I sat with the counselor. I voiced my discontent. And he finally admitted to the counselor he didn't want me on the trips, that it was a non-negotiable for him and I would just have to accept it. And I didn't handle that news well.
So after this, COVID hit and you were home together as a family. But this is where you find out that your husband was cheating at least once and that your instincts were right and you have been gaslit this whole entire time. So walk us through this.
Week one, I had 4 children homeschooling and now my husband was working from our bedroom office. And, you know, sadly, I was thrilled to have COVID because now I felt like we'd have more time with him. A worldwide pandemic was what it was going to take for me to get time and my children to get time with their dad. Thinking back on that, it's pathetic. But I thought maybe that would give our family a hard reset that we desperately needed. I was happy the idea the kids would come to know their dad better. Maybe they'd get more quality time with them. Within 3 days of lockdown, I was hanging on the back porch of our home and the kids with him and was looking at something on social media on his phone. And a text popped up that was from a woman to my husband and I didn't know. She was in the area of his job, which again is like an hour, hour and 15 from our home, and was making appointments to meet up. Now, this is in COVID lockdown. It was an invitation. It was clear it was an invitation for like a date or a physical encounter. That was the tone of it. And I immediately like lost it on him. Like I was like, what is this about? Why are you getting messages like this? And he blamed it on like phishing or just spam. And so I kind of stormed into the house. And he came in and just blurted out, like out of nowhere, I had an affair with a coworker 2 years ago. And I remember screaming. I remember, you know, asking him why, after all that time with counselors, when counselors had encouraged him to come clean in counseling, he would come clean during a lockdown. With a lockdown in place, I was trapped. He had to stay. If I tried to force him into a hotel, I'd have to help pay for it, which meant less money for the kids than I live off of. And if I asked him to go live with a relative, the only one that would have taken him in was his aunt. And at the time, she had cancer, so that wasn't an option. And then I was like, well, how are the kids going to visit with him under a lockdown situation? So, no, he had to remain in the home. And so I spent the next year locked up with him. And suffering from, I was diagnosed with PTSD. I would fall asleep for a bit and wake up panicked repeatedly every night. I was severely depressed. I lost about 10 pounds in a month. I was on a virtual appointment with a counselor 3 times a week at this point. And it was just angry, sad, and numb for months. So all those years of me feeling, you know, like I was unreasonable for wanting to go on the trips, I felt like a fool. You know, if you're physically abused, it's horrific, but you can see proof of it. With emotional, mental abuse, there's no proof. And so, you know, it just kept spiraling downward. During that time, you know, I really tried to hide from the kids what was going on. I would get into the car. I would say I was going to the supermarket. I'd pull over, get out of the car, scream and cry on the side of the road just to try to process it all because I had nowhere to process it with him home. I had to share space with him night and day. And I tried my best to keep everything as normal for the kids in spite of me honestly falling apart. I was just falling apart. Around the spring, the following year, COVID started lifting. And he asked me to take a trip with him to wipe the slate clean. That was a big request during the marriage. Can we just wipe the slate clean? Can we hit a hard reset? Can you forgive me and we start over? Now I know that's the cycle of abuse. Back then I didn't. I just thought it was my spouse asking me for forgiveness, for grace. And aren't we supposed to be forgiving in a marriage?
So you go on this trip, and the first thing that you notice is that he got a new credit card, and you stuff down your feelings here because he's got two different sets of rules now because he's got this credit card when he shouldn't be, and you don't have any of this stuff, and he's the person that's financially irresponsible. However, even though you see this, you're being love bombed on this trip. Kindness, attention is happening, future talk, promises to never cheat again are going on this trip. He says to you that he wants to be married forever and that he's sorry. And after all that, you forgive him. However, when you returned from this trip, things changed pretty quickly after you experienced physical abuse. So walk us through this.
So we went on this trip. When we returned from that weekend trip, I was just on cloud nine. I was sure we could get through it. I was like, we're stronger for it. And one day we decided we were going to take a walk in the park. And I cannot remember what I brought up. But I remember he got very angry at whatever topic it was. He was holding a coffee cup in his hand. There were women around. It was a beautiful day out, warm. And he started to scream at me and hauled the ceramic coffee cup he was holding in his hand at my head. And this was the first time I would say I was afraid of him and knew, what is he capable of? Okay, now he's capable of physical violence towards me. I stood frozen in the spot I was in. I remember telling him, as soon as we get home, you're going to pack your things up and you're going to leave. You're moving out. And I was scared to death to get in the car with him to drive home. Because in the past, if he had gotten angry and he was driving, it wasn't uncommon for him to drive the vehicle erratically or aggressively to intimidate me or scare me into being quiet with his erratic driving. If we had been in a park spot, let's say, and he didn't like something I was saying, he would throw it into reverse very quickly and abruptly to scare me. So now all these possibilities are running through my head of, am I even going to make it home safely to my kids? But he did. We got home fine and he started to pack. And I was just heartbroken. I was broken. I was heartbroken. I didn't know who he was anymore. I had no identity left. I had no clarity of mind. My peace and serenity were long gone. And it was all gone because of his abuse. I felt like I was in a smoke-filled room and I could not see clearly. He moved out. We separated for 12 weeks. And during those 12 weeks, I worked diligently with the counselors still to try and mend what little I could of the marriage to save it at any cost. I felt like I was hanging on the edge of a ledge and somebody was telling me, jump, meaning end the marriage. And I was like, I don't want to. I don't want to. It's my second marriage. I don't want to. I have four children. I don't want to. This isn't the man I married. I married a loving man, a wonderful man. He'll come back. It'll get better. I still could not accept that this was the permanent new reality in my mind. So I'm working diligently on that marriage. And during this time, he's acting very strange. He's living at his aunt and uncle's about an hour away in a big 4,000 square foot home. And he's distant. He's giving one word answers on text messages. He doesn't want to speak on the phone. If I ask him if he's reflected on his behavior, like of what's landed him at his aunt's, he keeps saying he hasn't had time with work. So it's not a priority. And I'm getting angry. I'm starting to get really angry with this lackadaisical attitude now because I'm home caring for four kids alone still. And now the counselor's getting vocal. He's telling me he's not rolling up his sleeves and doing the work. His words aren't matching his actions. And I'm going to drop him as a client because there's other people who want my time and want my help. And he's not one of them. I can't help him. And so he dropped him as a client. And when I saw the counselor drop him, that's when I really started to get concerned. Around this time, I started to notice him prioritizing things that were not what a man would prioritize when they're kicked out of their house, away from their wife and four kids. He was trying to draw up a phony lease so that he could get a free county golf membership. That was important for him. He was going out with a guy friend whose marriage had recently ended for pizza, you know, drinks. So it was becoming clear because I stood up for myself and kicked him out of the house. He was punishing me by living this carefree single life now. And I'm home caring for our children. Again, single-handedly. Around that time, the kids started going back and forth every other weekend to visit with him because it was important to me that they continue to get time with their dad in spite of what was going on. By mid-May, I would say I had a really honest and not so pleasant conversation with him. I explained to him I wasn't having his lukewarm attitude anymore. He had been there for 12 weeks. I was getting tired of this nonsense and I gave him an ultimatum and wasn't willing to really do the work to heal this marriage. I was going to make the decision for us.
So at this point, he comes home. He's still not contributing at all inside the home. And then also at this time, you know, you're having arguments. Sometimes he would lock you in rooms with him. There was a rage and intimidation here now. After this, you tell him to move to his aunt's. He refuses. He wants both of you to live in the home while divorce happens and you're feeling trapped. So things really have escalated during this period and you're panicking and rightfully so. So what happens from here?
And I start to unravel. I mean, I can feel myself unraveling. And I leave. I go to my parents' house nearby. And I start to have a complete nervous breakdown. I start crying uncontrollably. I can't stop. My dad is like, I need to bring you to the emergency room. You're not doing well. Everything I had been shouldering for all that time just crashed in. I couldn't shoulder it anymore. I had been so strong in front of my kids during a worldwide pandemic, and I could not take it anymore. I wound up in the ER that night in fetal position. I wasn't able to make eye contact. And the hospital recommended I do intensive outpatient therapy because I had PTSD. And I was really just a mess. And they said, do the IOP instead of the therapy you're doing now. Unfortunately, the waiting list to get that IOP was way too long. And I got home the next day and I told my ex where I was, because he never called, he never inquired, and I never phoned him. And he accused me of creating the entire situation of that breakdown for what he called optics for the court. So basically, he had the idea that I made up a nervous breakdown so that when I had to file for divorce with the court, I could show an image of a woman who was broken. That's telling of where his mind goes with image, that you would go to that length. Like, I was so ashamed that I had a breakdown I was mortified. And there's no shame to be had around that. That's what I felt. I felt shame and I felt guilt. And the only thing he was thinking about was what a smart maneuver that was. At that point, you know, I was just appalled. And I tell my dad, "Dad, we got to get me out of here. I got to get out." And so he starts to help me look for an apartment. And I find one rather quickly. I lucked out. I had two bedrooms. It meant I had to share a bedroom with my two daughters, and my two sons had to share a bedroom. So five of us are in a two-bedroom apartment, and I didn't care. It was in the same town we were in. I could keep my kids in the school system. And so my father and I signed this lease on the QT. He broke into my email 2 days later. He had a suspicion and found the lease agreement. And so I had to move out sooner. I lived in that apartment from that August. In September, I was at a concert with some girlfriends. I was really still devastated over the marriage ending. And I called him and we talked. And he said, "Please, I know you have the apartment. Why don't we just try working on the marriage? We'll get a new counselor." And when someone told me that women tend, on average, to go back to their abuser multiple times, if you had told me that years ago, I wouldn't have understood it. But now I understand it. I, for all logical reasons, should not have gone back. But my heart, this was my husband. This was my future. This was my family. This was my everything. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to give it one last chance. And so I kept the apartment. I never moved out of the apartment, but I moved into the house with the kids late October. We went through Halloween together. It was lovely. In November, I had a stroke. And he was wonderful for the stroke. Attentive, kind, loving, held the household down. Within a few days of being home from the stroke, we had gotten a Christmas tree. It was right after Thanksgiving. And we always get the Christmas tree early. And we put the tree up. And my one son was really struggling. Because look at all the transitions that had happened. Of course he was struggling. And I had just had a stroke. He was scared to death. And he started to have, you know, a bit of an emotional outburst, my son. And my ex picked him up to carry him downstairs. And I said, "No, just leave him. He's just sad. He's angry." And he said, "No, I'm not going to tolerate it." And he brought him downstairs. We had a bi-level, so I couldn't see what he did. And he sat on my son till he couldn't breathe and slapped him across the face. And at that point, when I discovered what he did, I left for good. I took the kids and we moved back into the apartment and I got divorced.
So now that you're at this point, you know, what are the things that are going on with, you know, your self-care and how are you feeling at this time?
Beautifully. I sleep soundly through the night now. I get counseling on the regular. I'm back in a helping field and fundraising. That has really helped to feel like I'm being used through my work in a way that can help others. And I'm a big advocate for domestic violence now. I spoke at a local domestic violence golf outing and told my story. And I know that I will continue in my life to take my experience and turn it into something beautiful. Because I don't want my story to just be a story. I want my story to be something that a woman who didn't have a dad maybe in her corner or didn't have a dad who would pay for an apartment. I mean, if I didn't have those things, I would have wound up in a shelter with my kids and that would have been fine. But I want women listening to this to not just hear a story, but say, "Oh, here's the tactics someone like this uses. Here's the signs." Because it's not always a quick relationship that shows you an abusive person. It could be a person you've been with for years.
And if you had any words of wisdom for everyone listening, what would they be?
Don't get hung up on what you have to leave behind in order to gain your freedom and your future. Take the few things you have, go to a shelter, and figure it out from there. You can get out. You are not trapped.
Well, Chaya, I really want to thank you for being here with us today. So I really can't thank you enough for being here with us today and sharing your story. And I know you're going to help at least one person, you know, and it's going to help them maneuver and get out. And you did that. And I really can't thank you enough.
Brandon, the pleasure is mine. And I really hope that I can be a voice for other women to know that you're not alone, you're not crazy, and you have the ability to get out.
Well, thank you, Chaya, once again for being our guest today. And if you want to be a guest on our Survivor Story episodes, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. At top of the page, there's a button that says Guest Form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our Guest Form page. And there you can read all of our instructions and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our Guest Form and press the Submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. Also at our website, we have a support group. So if you need support, we have a support group at narcissistapocalypse.com. Inside, you'll see that we have Zoom meetings every Wednesday night, Thursday afternoons, and Saturday nights. We have forum boards for you to post on to get the validation that you need from survivors just like you. It is a wonderful group of people on there, and you can make a lot of friends too. So if you need support, join our support group today. And if you need even more support, please do visit our friends at domesticshelters.org. At domesticshelters.org, they have articles and resources to help you make sense of what you're dealing with. They have every phone number, email address, and web address for shelters and agencies. No matter how big or small the town you're in, domesticshelters.org has it there. And we have another friend of a show called Shelter Movers, everyone. Sheltermovers.com is where you can reach them. And they help survivors of domestic violence and coercive control get all of their stuff out of their home and into storage. So if you need help getting all of your stuff out of your home and into storage, Sheltermovers.com can help you. They are a Canadian organization currently and a donor-supported charitable organization. So if you want to get help from them or support them, go to sheltermovers.com. And that is it for today's episode. So for myself and Chaya, we hope you have a good night.